serving God with my with strength. I'm giving you also an example of this. We didn't talk, and when I mentioned this, I'm talking about tying shoelaces. I didn't mention this, but you think about when you take your 3 steps forward in the Shmoneh Esrei, okay? You do, the halakha says, do it with your right first. Now believe you me, that's not going to make a difference whether Hashem hears your prayers or not, not hear your prayers. The idea is that we do things that are, and there's a great many things in our life to say, we do things that help formulate an attitude. Very often, and I mentioned this before, there is how Judaism believes that there's an interaction between what I do and what I think. Remember when I was dating, if I wanted to feel special, I dressed special. Right? When I was going out, or we go to the opera, you get dressed up. And it creates an aura of the experience. And I remember that when I was back in New York and I went to the opera, the matinee, Esther and I were all dressed up and nobody else was. And we felt terrible. But it was an emotional letdown. But in a very real sense, going with your right foot forward and doing it as a conscious willed act symbolizes wanting to serve God in strength. When you come down to the bima, I don't know if you ever realize that when they take the center down from the bima, they do this crazy jig. You ever notice? I don't know if you notice. The chazan comes down the bima, then he turns right, then he turns right, then he goes around. He keeps going right, right? Why did they go down the left side of the bima? He could simply go left and go around. Why does he go right, right, right? The answer is because the halacha dictates when you leave the bina, you want to take the center, go to the right. You always turn to the right. So you go around, they went around the shul, they do it to your right turn rather than doing the left turn first. Okay? And there's also symbolism. That when you go up to these, when one gets called up to a mitzvah or a kodesh, or is called up to give a divine Torah, the halacha dictates when you come up to serve God, you do it the short way. Go up fast. And when you come back, you go the long way because I don't want to leave. And when you come to God's presence, you go with your right foot first. When you leave God's presence, you do it with the left foot first. All these things, because you don't want to. You want to stay in God's presence. These are symbolic actions. The same thing is true in a concept that Allah has created of serving God by tying your shoelace. Okay? And it's I don't want to make more of it than it is, okay? But it's symbolic of you do your right foot, you put on your right foot first, shoe first, and then you put on your left shoe, and you tie, but here when it comes to tying, you tie the left, why? Because in tying, because of the mitzvah of tying tefillin on your left hand, and then left has priority, so you tie your left shoelace first. Now, we got into discussion, what do women do? And I pointed out that according to many poskim, in the case of the, when it comes to tying, you go by the person himself. We saw that in the Mishnah Berurah said that a lefty who ties tefillin on his right hand, he puts on tefillin, he ties his shoe, his right shoe first, not his left shoe first, because by him, tying is on the right has priority. In the case of women who are not obligated in tefillin, and here's the page that I quoted. This is the book I mentioned several times. It's called Halichot Beita. It's by the nephew of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Rav David Orbach, who's a rabbi in Tzfat. Okay, and he talks about the mitzvah of women. So let me just read the text on top. Ha'ish tzarich l'nol minal yamin tchila v'lo yikshorena, v'chakach l'nol shol smol v'yikshorena, v'yachzor v'yikshor shol yamin, u'kshecholetz menalad cholet shol smol tchila. Okay, now ubiisha yesh l'stapek im tzicha l'akpid k'shor tefillah shel smol, aval b'ni'ilat ha'na'alayim b'chalitzatan tzicha l'nol kamo ish. Okay, so it's essentially what he's saying, when you put on your shoes, you put it on right, that you do like men. As far as time is concerned, he doesn't know. And then the notes on the bottom, he brings the two sides. He says, and to summarize very briefly, what he says is, okay. What's it? What is it? That's from last week. That's from last week. been, it's not. If all the sheets were taken. Okay. All the store sheets were in the street. By the way, I printed up 40, there aren't 40 people here. So some people have two people, two copies in their house. I'd appreciate if they don't, then I have to print up more, which is a good problem. No, from the store sheets, these store sheets. If not, okay, then some of them. Don't worry, that's my problem, not yours. I'll take care of it. Okay, let's go. Let's see what he says inside. Okay, let me just summarize it, because what he essentially says is that when they're dealing with women who are, whether they should try to write you first or let you first, he says, on the one hand, we see the time has the let as part of it. On the other hand, we see that since women are not obligated in filling, so maybe they should, the right should go first. And those are the two sides, and essentially he leaves it unresolved, although he does say that his uncle, Shlomo Zalman Rambam Zitzal, says that women should do tie the right shoe first. All right. Now, yes. I'm not obligated to filling, right?
Absolutely.
Even if you did, I wouldn't panic. I wouldn't go into a panic. I'll attempt to dissuade you.
Okay, I have no intention.
Yes,
but
from wearing tefillin? I was planning to discuss this at some length, not at this moment, but the general halakhic policy is, yet women are not forbidden, they are very strongly dissuaded from doing so. There is, the halakha says, mochim yadam. The Jewish community attempts to tell the women not to do it, not to put on the tefillin. There's no Easter in that sense, an Easter don't like those. Mochin biyadam means objects. Okay. And it has to do with a variety of other things we'll talk about. Yes?
You said that tefillin has to be very pure, all kinds of things. How does Chabad take people on the street and have them start feeling? I thought of it after you said what you said. So.
Well, the answer is because the feeling is that for a short moment, the person who they're hopping to do the mitzvah and they're dealing with males who are obligated for that short moment, and they're agreeing to put on tefillin, their thoughts are dedicated to tefillin. They're probably in a total state of shock. Okay, let's now go back to the topic we were discussing, which is tzniut. And what we did last week, and I'd like to go through it very quickly, very briefly, is we started reading the Gemara after continuing my regular reading about feminism. We started getting into there about the tzniut, and we're now on page 5, and we're doing the Gemara Brachot. And we'll go through it again. And we saw that biblically, it's forbidden to daven or learn Torah in the presence of exposed genitalia, yours or somebody else's, male or female. It has nothing to do with sexual distraction. That has to do with the fact that exposed genitalia, biblically, you cannot have that in the presence of where you're trying to set up your machane shchina, where you're trying to set up your davening, just as it's forbidden to have exposure and tell you in God's presence where it is in the war camp. You're supposed to know you about Bachael Batabar. It's forbidden to have anything that's unseemly in God's presence in the war camp. So too says the Aruch HaShulchan, Reb Epstein, when I'm trying to set up within me, I'm trying to daven, I'm trying to set up within me a machane shchina, God's presence, one can have exposure and tell you. And that is understood by the poskim as being biblical. The rabbis then came along and extended the concept of erva. Erva means genitals. But Chazal extended that to sexual distraction. That is, I can't daven rabbinically when I'm sexually distracted. And the Chazal then went along and said, well, what is included in this rabbinic concept of erva? Okay. So this is the Gemara. Okay, we'll go through it very quickly. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, tefach b'isha erva. And et tefach b'isha, we're dalid in the stanza there. Rabbi Yitzchak says, tefach b'isha erva. an exposed area the size of a fist by a fist, which is approximately 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches, is considered erva. It's considered it has the same halachic status rabbinically as genitalia. The Gemara says lamai. For what purpose? Ilei malas dekuviva, if it is to stare at her. V'hamar Rav Sheshet said lama mana katuv tachshitin shebachutz im tachshitin shebefnim. Why did the Torah, when it's listing the spoils of this midyan, list that jewelry shebefnim and shebachutz? Excuse me, which is rings and earrings and nose rings and neck. Why did it list all that jewelry, external jewelry, in tachshitin befnim, that jewelry which was more private, it worn privately, which included chastity belts? Okay, so why did Torah mix it together? Anybody who looks for sexual pleasure, even at, and this is exaggeration, but even at the pinky of a woman, looking at her genitals. So the Gemara says, so to stare at someone, at a woman, for sexual pleasure is clearly forbidden. So what do I need Rabbi Yitzchak to teach me this? So he says, Ella b'ishtos m'bar, even looking at his wife, where sexual pleasure is permissible, ula p'yachma. Means looking at his wife, even during the recitation of creation, if his wife has an area that is exposed, that's normally covered, that is exposed the size of a tefach, 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches, you can't recite creation. So now, the Mishnah has now set up the possibility of rabbinic concept of erva, which relates to sexual distraction. By the way, on Pasalt, the Gemara talks about the concept of sexual distraction in general. The sexual distraction is forbidden, although we don't know why. Why is sexual distraction forbidden? What's bothering someone? Someone's sexually distracted, or some, why is there a problem? All right, we'll come back, we'll read a tshuva of motion in a moment. Amar Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda then goes on and says, Shok b'isha erva. Okay? Shok b'isha erva. And then we talked about it, we don't exactly know what shok is. The normative interpretation of shok is that it refers to the thigh. Although in modern, in Hebrew, even in biblical, shok normally means from the knee down. For argument's sake, let's not assume what the way the Mishnah learns, that shok is from the knee up. Because generally, it really should have been that this part, the bottom part of the leg is shok, and the top part is called yarech. Okay, but let's continue. Shok b'sheva. How do we know that a shok, it presents problems, an exposed area of the shok? Shenema. Nabi, when he's referring to the wayward actions of the Benot Yisrael, he says, reveal your shok, cross the waters, and then the next part of the verse, Tigal el vatech, expose your nakedness, and your shame will be seen as well. So you see here that there's a parallelism here between uncovering your shok and uncovering your nakedness. So you see that this has a this is considered from this. This is at least a mnemonic device to see that shok is a form of nakedness. On this particular verse, we asked a variety of questions too. Shok is clearly normally covered. So why do I have to say shok? That's under tevach b'isha erva. I mean, it's a prayer that's normally covered. What does Rav Chisda come to teach me? And I mentioned again, we have to see how it's codified in law. But we saw various interpretations, some of which are contradictory. One says that shok, that while normally an area that's covered requires a tefach, by shok, which is closer to the genital area, it's even more erotic, and therefore it's even less than a tefach. Even less than a tefach presents a problem. If you're talking about, or some other people say, well, something often when a woman's working, the shok will be it's partially exposed. So there might be less of a problem with shok. So these are contradictory interpretations. We'll see how it what works its way out in the codification.
How much is the tefach?
Tefach is approximately is an, it's about 3.5 inches by 3.5 inches. Okay, so tefach is this much.
Yeah. A
fist,
okay,
like 4 fingers.
Okay.
But 4 average fingers, and if you measure your fingers, you'll see it's about 3.5 inches.
Your own, or my own, or anybody else's.
It's the average fist. The average fist. That's why I said it's about approximately 3.5 inches. And then also there's the Chanai Shita, the Chazoni Shita. Don't get me on a couple of things. All right. Amar Shmuel. Okay, let's now move on to the next thing. Amar Shmuel. Kol b'isherba, the voice of a woman is erva, shenemar ki kolech arev umarech navet, because your voice is pleasant and your visage is pleasant, is also becoming. And again, we'll have to talk about what voice we're talking about. Speaking voice. Right? If you hear a woman's talking, you can't daven. Is that what the halacha means? Is a Jewish woman? What does kol isha mean? Does it mean Jewish women, non-Jewish women, married women, single women?
A sing-song
voice. What are we talking? What are we talking about? Because there's no statements here. We have to see exactly. We have to get some idea of what we're referring to here, and that we have to as we go through the halacha. If we don't answer that question, well, we'll definitely answer the question. If we don't, but then to your satisfaction, then please ask. Amar Rav Sheshet said, Seyam b'sheva. The exposed hair of a woman is considered erova. Okay? Shenemal sa'arech keterizim. You see in Shir Shirim it says, your hair is like the hair of the sheep.
There's no
enayim b'sheva.
Yeah,
each
to
his own.
They missed enayim b'sheva.
What? Miss Day Nine, the Isha Erva. Okay, okay, that, see, that question really doesn't bother me because, as I told you, why doesn't that question bother me? Because it's very clear that this is rabbinic in origin. It's very clear that the motivation is sexual distraction, all right, and while your husband may love your teeth. the halacha is attempting to search for things that they feel are paradigmatic of things that cause sexual distraction. So these are the examples the Torah gives. Now, this now presents a problem, and one of the questions we're going to have to deal with as we go through the source, through the halacha, and what we're going to do is essentially attempt to give you a group of poskim, as we'll call the machmirin, the stringent school, and the lenient school, and give you a feeling of what they have, because there's a tremendous amount of discussion on this. But you get a feeling of what the sources are and where we're going. Yes, there is a lenient school in Sniut. Yeah. You know, they don't teach it, but it does exist. And I hope to demonstrate that too. Okay, now, some of the questions we have to ask is, are these examples? That is the guiding principle sexual distraction? And tefach and shok and kol are merely examples. Or are Chazal saying, yeah, sexual distraction is really a problem. But these four, that's it. You know, the rule is on the books. What's the difference? Suppose people don't no longer sexually distracted by kol. So those people are no longer sexually distracted by Seyar. Is there a relative concept in these things? I mean, do we say, Chazal merely giving examples that in their time, all women walked with their hair covered. In fact, they walked not with their hair covered, with their face covered. And that's like Saudi Arabia. That was normative experience, depending certainly in the Muslim countries to this day. In fact, I think I have a picture somewhere.
What?
Smachta is the way Chazal establish rabbinic ordinances. And the way they do that, since things were transmitted orally, they use the verses as mnemonic devices.
Are you gay?
No, it's not a gay. Right? Why are you gay?
It's a memory.
It's like code.
It is a memory tool, but you have to understand very often they took the asmachta very seriously. That is, the fact they picked this verse as asmachta teaches me certain things about the way they view the ordinance. But it's a mnemonic device. The source, the verse, does not refer to this. It's not the God's intention. Yishayo, when he says Gali Shoki Rinarot, it was not talking about Shoki Yisharva. Or Ki Kolecha Reva Marech Naveh, it was not talking about sexual distraction. Chazal used this as a device, or as a sex, as a text to show sexual distraction. You see that since Shirashir, he prays that he talks about it, you see that these things can be sexually distracted. But if there are inconsistencies, it shouldn't bother you because, as I pointed out, this is not the only thing. I mean, in Shir Hashem, how do you deal with the fact that Shir Hashem mentions teeth? It mentions her hands, it mentions her neck. And no posek ever thought that there's a problem. Because the posek can say, because those are not sexually distracting. If the if you understand the mechanism, it's not going to bother you. If the mechanism doesn't bother, it shouldn't bother you. What's bothering?
I don't see. They're basing it on what they believe to be the truth. Then why do they need the asmachta? Mm-hmm. It doesn't. If there's no connection between the asmachta and the
asmachta means when I as a Jew who reads your shir from time to time, when I hear the verse, I say, that's the source of that's the rabbinic mnemonic verse called the shir. That the verse, since things were transmitted orally, things were not written down in the Gemara, right? Until much later, until the 400 to 500 of the Common Era, depending on the Yerushalmi, the Bavli, things were not written down. So how did they needed some. So truth of the matter is they went home and they all had jib sheets. They went home and they wrote for themselves at home after they came on the Yeshiva. But what they would do is, as they were learning of the written text, that was written down, served as the text that served them all sorts of hints to various halachot.
That would be very distracting to be reading one thing and be thinking about a lot.
Hmm. Provided you know how the mechanism works. And part of the problem is when you're dealing with a smachta, is to know if that's what the verse meant or if that's an asmachta. And there are discussions in the Gemara at times, certainly the Rishon, whether it's an asmachta or it's a real drasha. And there are, some of the times are very, very complicated. What we were talking about, I think, when I were talking about women counting for a minyan, I don't know if you remember, and I said, that even though it sounds like a real drasha, right? This verse is only talking about martyrdom. The verse is talking about martyrdom. Based on martyrdom, Chazal extended and used the same verse for counting for a minyan, that the count of minyan, just as by martyrdom, which is the ultimate sanctifying God's name. You need 10, and you learn from minyan dashti betoch b'nei and the meraglim, you learn that, you learn that's a real drasha. When it was now applied to minyan, that was merely a mnemonic device. Just as by martyrdom, so when the rabbi set up the whole concept of minyan, they did the same thing. But then it shouldn't bother you that by martyrdom, the majority of people hold that women do count for minyan, and by public prayer, by minyan, women don't count. And it's from the same verse. How is that possible? Why the inconsistency? The answer is because by public prayer, it has to do with obligation. The whole principle is obligation. By martyrdom, women are obligated, that's where they count. By public prayer, women are not obligated, that's where they don't count. The fact that it's the same verse, that shouldn't bother you. Okay, one is a real drasha, one is a mnemonic device. Okay.
If men love anyone,
Well,
if men go to
shul in the morning, maybe it's not like that if women showed up for chakras, they might arise. But but men don't always come in the shul, you know.
Just if they hold the
shul. Okay. There are a lot of things that we have to discuss here. In terms of, I say every share, but one of the questions that I asked Well, does it say anything about married women or unmarried women? It doesn't say. It says nothing here. And there's no source in the text here that there, we should assume that it's only married women, as the halacha does seem to come down, although there's some minor dissenting opinions. All right. Let's now move on to the next source. Okay? But in order to get into the discussion, we have to learn the sources. Yes? Why do I interpret Shok? Because I'm prejudiced by the Mishnah Berurah. And I'm sending you up. I'm sending you up from Machlok between the Mishnah Berurah and the Chazon Ish. Okay, that's what I'm learning it that way. I'll tell you something. The question is a very good one. Rashi, when he interprets, Rashi very often in the Mishnah, when Rashi's commentary to the Gemara, okay? So Rashi will learn the Mishnah wrong. Okay, you learn the Mishnah wrong. And when I was a kid, I always said, why did Rashi learn the Mishnah wrong? Teach it. Pshat in the Mishnah wrong. Because if you don't learn the Mishnah wrong, you'll never understand what bothers the Gemara. So you learned it right. By the way, the Gemara learns at the end, and then you understand the Gemara's question. So Rashi, as a teacher, he's trying to work you through the text, teaches the Mishnah with its the presumption in the Mishnah was such, and Rashi teaches, even though at the end, well, sort of Rashi in the Chumash, okay, already knows the Gemara's conclusion, he teaches. So very often you'll see the same Mishnah taught you by Rashi in the Chumash one way, and Rashi on the Mishnah another way. And you have to be very careful, you know, how you, you know, knowing what Rashi is, what's his function in each text. You're 100% right. I'm teaching it not wrong, I'm teaching it prejudice so that you'll understand the problem as we hit it. Okay? Alright, the next text we're gonna read is a very interesting Gemara in Ketubot. Okay. The Gemara Ketubot, next page on page 6, deals with you have text now. Does somebody want to, there's somebody else sitting next to them that can give these ladies a text, so.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Gemara Ketuba goes as follows. Ve'elu yotzot shelo b'ketuba. Now, the Gemara is now dealing grounds for divorce with the loss of the Ketuba. That means it's essentially, this is a penalty. We are penalizing this woman for improper action, okay, and in doing so, since she's at fault, there is cause here, a serious cause for divorce. She's at fault. She loses the ketuba. Ve'eli yotzot shelo b'ketuba. I think that the Beis Din can force. Does he have to divorce her? I don't think so. But the Beis Din, he can come and sue for divorce. He can come and sue divorce for divorce. Yes.
No. He doesn't have
them. That's a good question.
He can't divorce.
It's not a trivial question. It's not a trivial question because as we go through, you'll see that once we learn the Mishnah and then we'll ask the question a little later. Okay. Ve'elu yotzot v'lo shelo b'ketuba. And these are women who, when they are divorced, lose their ketuba. Ha'overet al dat Moshe v'Yehudi, a woman who violates the ordinances or the religion, so to speak, of Moshe and Yehudit. Okay. Now, what is dat Moshe? What is dat Yehudit? Okay. So the Mishnah says, ve'ezuhi dat Moshe. Yeah. What is dat Moshe? Machilat. So let me tell you now what that Moshe is, and you'll see. That Moshe is when she does that which violates biblical law, Mosaic law, that Moshe, as it regards him. It doesn't say that she loses it too well, she's Mechal Shabbos. But if she does that which affects him, she feeds him trey food. Okay? That is, these are things that she does as a wife for her husband, and she is machshil. She causes him to violate. Let's see what it is. Ve'ezeridat Moshe, machirato shein musar. She doesn't take off trumot to masvot, and she feeds her husband food, which is not musar. U'meshamashto nida, and she sleeps with him when she's in nida. Ve'lo kutza lachala, and she doesn't, she bakes bread for her family, and she doesn't take off chala. Ve'noderet ve'ena makemesh, she makes oaths and doesn't keep them. So the Gemara doesn't ask, I don't want to go into the Gemara asking, well, why does that to me? She makes a neder, it's her problem. Why does it affect him? Let's not get into that. Ve'ezohi dat yudit. And what is dat yudit? Okay? Now, do me a favor, look up at Rashi. Rashi is on the right hand side of the page, over here. You see what it says, matnitin?
Yes.
Right here it says, matnitin. By the way, matnitin means mishnatenu. It's Aramaic, the Mishnah. We're now reading the Mishnah in this Gemara. Matin, everybody have a place? But how does Rashi interpret dat yudit? Shenahagu b'not Yisrael, these are customs of the daughters of Israel, the af-al-gab de lo k'tiva, even though it's not written. These are customs, and to be more specific, modesty customs. Customs of modesty of the daughters of Israel, even though it's not written in the text. Let me just give you a few other interpretations. Dat miru de miri. Okay, the miri says the following. Dat Moshe ne'emar al mitzvot ha'ktuvot b'Torah o ha'umuzot ba. Dat Moshe refers to laws that are either written in the Torah or hinted in the Torah. Remember this for future reference. The Nehemiah says Dat Moshe includes even things that are hinted to in the Torah. There's a clear hint. We'll come back to that later. V'dat Yehudit. What is Dat Yehudit? Hu ne'emar al minhagim Hanehugim ba'uma mitzat tzniut. These are customs of modesty that are customary amongst Jewish women. Liyot benot Yisrael, the Jewish women, yeterot b'midat tzniut al kol shar nashim. The Jewish women are more modest than the other women, the women around. Okay. The Rush on this says v'dat Yehudit. Why does she lose her ketubah? Remember, she will lose her ketubah. She violates that yudit, she's doing ketubah. Mishum chatzifuta, because of her brazenness, sexual brazenness. Or mishum chshad znut, hu demafsada. Because she continues to act brazenly, and there's grounds to assume that maybe she's been immodest, not only in act, but perhaps in deed, not only in external acts, but also in deed, perhaps she's and even slept around, and because and actually she's warned and she continues to violate, she doesn't care, then she loses her ketubah. Okay, so what are the examples of a woman who loses her ketubah because of this violation of sexual mores? Okay? Ve'eza dat Yehudit, yotzah ve'rosha parua. She goes out with her hair loose and uncovered. Okay? V'tava b'shuk, and she knits in the shuk. U'medaberet em kol adam, and she flirts with everybody. Okay, now, this problem of clearly we're going to come back. We're going to talk. We talk about like women covering their hair, an obligation. We'll talk about it, whether it's a biblical obligation, a rabbinic obligation, whether it's a biblical custom from biblical times. We'll go into analysis. What's an absolute custom, relative? We will go into this, and that is we'll discuss that a little bit later. But I just want to deal with one thing. Turn to the next page. And what I'd like you to read is just the seventh line. It says, "V'tava b'shuk," and she knits in the marketplace. So of course you're saying, knitting in the marketplace. I'll make you vote for that. What's the problem with knitting in the marketplace? right? The Tava B'Shuk. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Gemar'eh Zro'otel Levnei Adam. That, the problem is not the knitting in the marketplace. The problem is that when she knits, her sleeves roll up and she keeps knitting. Doesn't bother. That she's essentially exposing her arms, and it, she continues, it doesn't bother her. And she's warned about it, about this amount, and she continues to do so. Okay, we're not finished yet. Rav Chisda Amar, Rav Chisda Amar Rime, Betava Vered Keneged Paneh. This is even more. She sits so that, and she knits so that the thread goes between her legs. And their attempting is to be more seductive. We'll leave it that way.
This
is tabam, weaving, right?
Maybe because it's a loom.
I don't know. No, it, well, whatever the exact process, you may be right. The process is one that is brings attention to certain parts.
If it's a spinning wheel, it really depends.
It may be a spinning wheel. You may be 100% right. Maybe so. The problem, according to the first one. The point I'm trying to make here, okay? The point is that she's acting in a seductive fashion. And they bring it to her attention, and she persists in doing it. She doesn't bother, she doesn't care. Now, the question, the point about weaving in such a way, it's not, you're right, Tavaz, it's weaving, in a such a fashion that her arms are exposed, this is the source of a problem with arms. Because until now, all we saw was shoking, now we have a specific reference here that exposed arms is a violation of Dak Yehudi. That's why, that's one of the reasons. So we now have two things, principles we learned without going into great detail about Kisui Seir that we'll do right around. That there is a prohibition for married women to go with their hair exposed. And also there's a prohibition for exposed arms. Now, we're going to go through the Gemara now on the bottom of page 6. Okay, we're going very quickly just to get a taste of the Gemara. Okay, the very next to last line. Next to last line, we're just going to go through the source, not in depth, just a superficial understanding of the text. So when we deal with these concepts, and by we deal with tzniut, we'll have a background. Gemara asks, Ezo hi dat yudit, and the Gemara gives an example. Yotzava lo shaper, her hair is exposed. Okay? Hair is exposed. Okay. We'll deal with it. Okay, Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg deals at great length with what the word pahua means. Okay, he demonstrates, he does a very in-depth analysis, and his analysis leads him to the conclusion that the word pahua, okay, means exposed. It also means, because in the past you'll see. Now, what we're going to be referring to in a moment is this woman is accused of being an adulteress. Okay, the Sota service. And what happens in the Sota service, one of the things that the Kohen does is uncovers her hair. Okay, uncovers her hair. Okay, Ufarah Rosh Ishai. The Kohen uncovers her hair. So the Gemara asks his father, "Ve'ezel dat Yehudit yotzah v'rosha parua." Her hair is exposed. The Gemara says, "Rosha parua doraita." Why did you say that a woman who goes out in the marketplace violates only dat Yehudit, only violates this custom of modesty? There's a biblical obligation. Doraita, dichtiv ufara rosh isha. It says that the Kohen uncovered her hair, which implies, we're going to get into this because it's very important. It's very important why her hair is covered. is her hair, the fact that her hair, clearly the Gemara is now deriding, you see her hair was covered. And the Kohen has to come along now and uncover her hair. So the question is, why was her hair covered? The Gemara's assumption is, you see, biblically, that a woman's, that a married woman's hair is supposed to be covered. Now the word supposed is very, is the linchpin here. Why supposed? Is it supposed because the Torah required her to cover her hair? Problem, big problem, nowhere does it say that a married woman has to, we don't have a mitzvah to say anywhere in the Torah that says cover your hair. Is it only because it's a custom to cover your hair? Maybe it was a custom there, but maybe in the 1920s it stopped being a custom. Customs can change. Now these are the type of things we have to analyze, understand. There's even those of all that's only rabbinic in origin. And this is merely a mnemonic device. I don't want to go as an asmachta, a mnemonic device. Okay, but let's take the Gemara now and its simple interpretation. Okay? Ufara Rosh Isha. Vitana Dve Rabbi Shnahasa Rabbi Shmuel learned on this verse. Do you see from this verse that the Torah is telling us that since the Kohen uncovered her hair, here we see that, that as a biblical, that's how he learns, Jack, and it doesn't stay with me, that there's a biblical requirement for a married woman to cover her hair.
He says, not Israel.
The daughters of Israel. Very good. Daughters of Israel. So you're saying maybe it means married, unmarried, even unmarried. The understanding is it's referring to daughters because the whole service is refers to a married woman. But I don't want to, I'm not shunting, when we come to doing this a little more in depth, we have to ask that question and we'll deal with it. Shh. So now the last word. D'oraita, not certain. D'oraita, the word says, you're right. You're right. The origin of a married woman to cover her hair is biblical. But what does it include? D'oraita kaltashapir dami. As far as the Torah is concerned, the oraita min haTorah, kaltashapir dami. A basket with holes that you can see the hair through, some minimal covering, shapir dami, that's good enough. D'oraita, even if a lot of hair is showing, even if it's hanging down, it's exposed, you can see the thing, it's good enough. As long as she has some minimal covering of her hair, that's good enough. Kaltashapir dami, a basket, a straw basket is good enough. That you did, but as far as the customs of modesty are concerned, afilu kalta nami asur. Even kalta is not enough. That you have to have the whole head covered. And now what it includes, right? What it includes is we'll have to see much, we'll see greater length later on. Okay. Let's continue on. Amar Rav Asi, Amar Rav Yochanan, Rav Asi asked the name of said in the name of Yochan, kalta, the woman who wears a kalta, ain ba mishum perua rosh. Okay? Kalta is not a problem of hair exposure. And if she wears a kalta, it's good enough. Hair exposure. So how do you bar Rav Zera? Rav Zera, okay, dealt with it. I mean, he didn't like the statement. There's a problem with the statement. What did Rav Yochanan come to teach him? Avi bar Rav Zera, Rav Zera dealt with this. Heicha, where are we talking about? Ilema bashuk, if we're talking in the marketplace, dat yehuditi, according to the laws of custom of modesty, okay, dat yehudit requires you to in the marketplace to wear your whole head covered. A kalta is not good enough. Right? So you see that what? So you see that the Rabbi Yochanan statement can't refer to the marketplace, because in the marketplace, kalta is not enough. Ve'ela b'chatzer, but what are you going to tell me he's referring to in her backyard, in the privacy of her home, even if that's outside, but it's her private backyard. Im kein lo hinachta bat l'Avraham Avinu shir shemet tachet bala. If you mean to tell me that she's got to wear a kalta, what does Rabbi Yochanan come to me? It's in her backyard. And if she wears a kalta, it's good enough. So it means that you have to wear a kalta in the backyard, your private backyard. Nobody's there. It's my private home. I got to wear a kalta. A woman's got to wear a kalta. In kein lo hinachta bat l'Avraham Avinu shir shemet tachet bala. You won't have You won't have any woman, daughter of Avram, sitting in her husband's house. And they'd have to divorce all of these women. Because all Jewish women, in the privacy of their home, go with their hair uncovered. What do you mean she's got to wear her hair covered? Okay, let's try it again. Rabbi Yochanan said, the kalta is good enough that she's got to wear something, but kalta is good enough. So the Gemara says, what is he referring to? He's referring to in the marketplace. What do you mean in the marketplace? Dak Yehudit requires what? That you wear a completed covering. So what does it mean? In the privacy of your home, you mean to tell me that Rabbi Yochanan again said, the privacy of a woman's home, she's got to wear her hair covered? Then we have to divorce everybody. Because all the women are immodest. Everybody goes that way. So you see, the Gemara is rejecting that interpretation by the fact of what people did. I mean, no women didn't, and more exceptional women did, but no, the general rule is women didn't wear their hair covered in the privacy of their home. So that can't be what it'd be open and said. So the Gemara says, okay, so Amar Abaye Vitev Rakana, Michatza Lachatza Derach Mavoi. We're going from private area to private area via semi-public area. You have to understand, I should draw a diagram, I wasn't preparing to go into such depth, but you had a public area. You had a public area. And then you had like a small alleyway that led off the public thoroughfare. And from this private alleyway, there were private Rabbi Yochanan, if you're going from one chatzer to another chatzer via this semi-private, semi-public area, the cop is good enough. You don't have to put on the whole shebang. Shebang, you put on the whole thing. You got to put on when you go out to the shuk. But if you're only going from a chatzer to a chatzer, you can't walk out in a mahoy with nothing. And the chatzer, you can wear. It's your private area. You don't have to wear your hair covered. But if you go to the semi-private, semi-public area, you got to wear a cap. That's what Rabbi Yochanan is referring to. Okay. Let me now make it very clear. Let's sort of summarize what we learned. Notice, not once in this whole discussion here in Ketubah was the word erva ever mentioned. We're talking about something completely different. This is a woman's obligation. The source of it, we're not going to analyze now. There's some halakhic obligation that a married woman cover her hair. That is from Ufarah Hosikah. We learn from the Sota service in the Kohen uncovered hair. You see that essentially the married woman's hair was covered. However, it may have nothing to do with sexual distraction. Okay? It was considered improper to walk that way, it was considered immodest to walk that way. But the word erva is not mentioned. Seir Misha Erva is not mentioned, and has a total different halachic source. It doesn't say a married woman's got to walk around with her hair covered because of Seir Misha Erva, did it? It said she has to wear her hair covered because Ufara Hoshisha. So that's a totally different concept than there's some sort of mixing up. As you go through the source, you have to keep it clear that this is a completely different obligation. One could argue the fact that a married woman had to cover her hair, that's what created the concept of sexual distraction when she uncovered it. Got it? Try it again. It may be that the fact, it may very well be, that the fact that a married woman is obligated to cover her hair is what created the sexual distraction element and when she uncovered it. So just as by tepah, we say it's normally covered, and then when she uncovered, she's exposing an area that's normally considered covered. Okay. Very good. Now we've essentially gone through the major sources that we have to deal with in Sniut. What I'd like to do is, before we hit the Shulchan Aruch, I want to take a step back, and I want to deal with the fundamental question, why is sexual distraction a problem? Okay. And is there a difference between men and women when it comes to sexual distraction? Let me ask Let me ask a very simple question. Is it more permissible for women to read hype novels than it is for men? Okay? I mean it very seriously. Is there some sort of, is there a difference? Okay. So let's now turn the next page, page 8. And we're now going to read.
Why should it be more permissible?
Why should it be more permissible?
Why should it be?
Good question.
What would be menu?
Your question is.
Good
for the
you
stuff.
Said
three
more than. I won't talk
about that.
You said that before we get there. Going God will cause every hunk of us for hair. Why?
That's a good question.
No.
Okay, one interpretation of Rashi is that we're reenacting what she did. Sort of, we're saying that you uncovered your hair to, as a seduction or in the lovemaking to your, in the adulteress, when you're an adulteress. We expose in public what you've done. Okay, but Rashi deals with this problem. Okay, and by the way, this is not the only possible interpretation. Ms. Talbot, this is not the only possible interpretation, and it has ramifications. The answer to the question you asked me, why do we expose her, or what are we doing when we expose her, has a lot of ramifications. Is the prohibition of thou shalt not, is it a thou shalt, it has all sorts of ramifications. So I'll come back to the question, but just to give you a taste of what how the post works. Okay. This response was written in 1951, Tov Shingen Aleph, okay? And the question goes as follows. Vihine, mashelot shesha'alta. No, let's not do that paragraph. Okay. Yes. Okay. Vihine, mashelot shesha'alta. Second paragraph. You see that? Yesh dvarim shekasher ledaber behem mitzad rov ha'pirtza. There are things that are difficult to talk about. I don't know if anybody remembers the 50s. women walking around sleeveless was very common. Okay, it was very normative, right? Am I correct? All right. So this question essentially is being catalyzed by that particular phenomenon. Anyways, he said, "V'nei me'ashelot sha'alta, the questions you asked me, yesh dvarim shekasher ledaber behem, the things that are kind of hard to talk about," he says. "Mitzad rov ha'pirtza, because it's so widespread, the violation is so widespread, shefar beik shirim v'yirei Hashem nefatsu b'zeh b'avonotenu b'rabim." Because even people are considered kasher, and these are good Jews. He says, but they violate it too, and people don't view it as a problem. And then he says, "V'ayin b'turei zahav," one of the major commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch, in Choshen Mishmat Simin Shin Sadi Gimel, B'shem Marashal, in honor of Shlomo Luria, who lived in the 1500s, "Af b'doram linyin zvon begulot." But they too, in their time, had a problem of women walking around with this. I mean, it's not a new phenomenon. This is, we in the 1500s had the same problem. Zachei lo ashid b'zeh, I don't want to go into too much detail about this problem. V'shomer nafsho yechat mikol kiyotze b'zeh, and he watches the soul, she's careful about such things. Ach bedvarim ha'acherim ashiv ha'nachon ha'dati. But the rest of the things that you talked about in your letter, you ask me, I'll deal with. V'nei shnei inyanei isu hiru yesh. There are two problems with thoughts. Yehogim are thoughts, but here we're talking about sexual thoughts. Yesh ha'echad mikra de'v'neshmarta mechol davar ra. Guard yourself from all that is which is evil. Ketubot dat mevav she'it Hashem mikan, based on this verse, mikan, third paragraph on the third line, mikan amar Rav Pinchas ben Yair, al yaharer adam bayom, yivol de'tumah balayla. Okay, a man, and here we're talking specifically about a man, should not sit and should have fantasies, sexual fantasies, during the day, because it'll bring to him, it'll cause him to have a nocturnal emission at night. She isu zehu af b'ishto. And one is not supposed to fantasize even about his wife during the day, even though the sexual act is permissible. Shehi mutevet lo. Okay, because he may have a nocturnal emission at night if he doesn't think of his wife. That is, now I have to understand, what is the problem with a nocturnal emission? The halacha views wasting of the semen as wasting the potential for bearing life, okay? And while it's not murder, it's not even an abortion, although in a mystical sense the Zohar views it very seriously, it's considered not a good thing. It's wasting the potential for life. There is no comparable action by women. So since there's no comparable action by women, this is something, according to the way we understand, this is something very unique to men. That a man has to be careful of not doing those things which cause him to have a nocturnal emission is a problem. A man is not even allowed to fantasize about his wife, right, during the day, because he may delete to nocturnal emission at night. And that is a permissible sex fantasy. וכן מה שאסור להסתכל באישה נידה אפילו פנויה ובאשת איש אפילו מכוערת. No, the halacha again, you're not allowed to fantasize. A man is not supposed to get sexual pleasure by looking at a woman who's a nida, even if she's, you're going to eventually marry her. She's a pnuya. Ubeeshet ish, ubegdei tzeva shel isha hamekira, or looking at the beautiful garments of it, even if she's not wearing it, if it's on the laundry line, but you're looking at the clothing and having a sexual fantasy. And halacha warns about even watching animals copulate. That's forbidden for a man. Ma?
That's just for men,
essentially, according to the way Rav Moshe seems to understand it, that's a problem for men.
Can I go back to something that you read here?
Any girl of the age of puberty is not married.
But it's notice the world is, what's the world? I told you that the word istaklut means to derive pleasure. To derive pleasure. No, but that's to derive pleasure. I told you there's looking, the three terms were looking, staring, and mirroring. Staring is looking at it to derive this. For a man, there's a real problem with the Miss America. Even if it's not leering.
Voyeurs.
What?
It's voyeurs.
Voyeurs. Right, could be.
Is it presumption that if someone's a farmer, it's so common that doesn't bring
that is, to yes, that. You are right. You're 100% right. This is his business. A farmer, a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, the halacha deals with the doctor's a gynecologist, or deals with the man who's in the business, all right? Or he's a farmer, he's this part of his life. Yes, that is permissible. We're talking about the average person. And this concept of, now this relative concept can be extended conceptually, but to a variety of other things in Sneot, or there are those who want to, but at least in your particular case, since his senses are sated, and this is his business, he doesn't think twice about it. Okay. And what's the reason? I'm sorry, we're in that third paragraph, line 3, 6, 7. And animals that are copulating, also learned from this verse, all right, that nishmata mikol davarat, to stay away from that which is improper, not because we presume he's going to fantasize about doing an avera, that which is forbidden, avera ima. Even if he's not thinking about doing an avira, because this will cause him to a nocturnal emission, because it's forbidden to willfully do so, and even by accident it's considered improper. Okay, so that's one verse that Rav Moshe deals with, and that's uniquely to men. V'hashini, but there is a second prohibition. Mikrad achar lo tatuach elavavkan v'achrei enechem. The darish b'brachot av yudbet, ze hiru avera. That was about having a sexual relation to do that which is forbidden. Einu mitzad kshash hotzad zer levatar. That has nothing to do with emission of the semen for naught. Elahu isum alahel asot avera. It is not that, because it's forbidden to have sexual thoughts that will lead to violation. Kamo had the darish machel avavchem hiru avodah zara. Do la'avor isu avodah zara shatora asra behu af ha'machshava la'avor. That the Torah forbade. Lo sotu achel avavchem v'achrei enechem. The Gemara says, avachel avavchem, that's to worship avodah zara, idolatry. And achrei enechem, that refers to have sexual relations. He learns that these two isurim are forbidden even in thought. Now you have to understand, this is not a trivial problem, because Jewish law does not generally forbid thought. But according to Moshe, there are two instances in which the Torah forbids thought, okay, that there's a prohibition on thought, and one is thought to do worship idolatry, and the other one is that forbidden sexual relations. Okay. Now, skip down. You see where the underlining begins again? Okay, you said the second column, what? Excellent. Lo tachmod, says the Ramban, is only, there's a big discussion in the poskim, you only violate when you do the act. That is, if I lust my neighbor's wife, I'm talking about tachmod, okay? And not lo tatuma, but I'm talking about lo tachmod. According to the Ramban, I only violate lo tachmod when I actually act. When I act, then I retroactively have violated lo tinaf and lo tachmod. Or if I lo tachmod my friend's horse, and I go ahead and steal the horse, then I was over lo tignov and lo tachmod. But the thought alone is not forbidden. That's how the Rambam is trapped. And he's bothered by the fact that Judaism does not forbid thoughts alone. And as we have the very statement, Machshava ra'ah ena kadosh baruch hu mitzafa l'maaseh. That is, we don't normally forbid that which is just thought alone. Uman, okay, skip now, we're skipping down with that second column now, sort of halfway down where the underlining begins. Umash shigam rav ami yalev mi'er v'onan. Afshu gam the mevi atzmo lidei hiru, tzarich lomar shu mitzad hasvara, kiven di isu. Now he's trying to explain to you what the problem of nocturnal emission. And we learn out from onanism, that is a man who masturbates, is considered, that there is a prohibition that's considered prohibited. Again, the problem is whether it's biblical, rabbinic, mystical. I don't want to go into that again. It's a very complicated issue. So he says, but it's clearly a prohibition. There is a prohibition of emission of the semen for naught. So tzarich lomar shu mitzad hasvara. It's logical. The kiven di isur zer levatala chamur shevahotza biyadayim chayav mita bidei shemayim. Mita doesn't mean that. It means mita bidei shemayim, the divine punishment. That is, one who masturbates, there is a halachic problem and is worth a divine punishment. Lachem vade le'inyan shura b'nei Hashem hu af shelo b'maseh. If it occurs even spontaneously, a nocturnal emission, that's also considered improper. Let's skip down to the next paragraph. Now get to it. V'lachem, yesh chiluk b'nashim, de'b'isur hirhur mikrad v'nishmartem letno. If it's merely fantasizing about some sex relations, which is permissible, can a woman fantasize about during the day about having sex with her husband? Right? No, the eno gorem lahen shum davar b'mishmush. Doesn't cause any problem. Right? And even a woman, she get excited and the like. It's not halachic. Even if she can get induce an orgasm of some sort, that's still not a halachic problem. Okay? Ein shem nida. The koshiken shalu yigram biyehu. Even though there is a halakhic tradition that a woman sometimes can it can cause, excitation can cause staining. And here, I'm sure this, what's the problem of a woman having breakthrough bleeding? I mean, is that an issue? Is that a lot of problem? She says, I don't see, says, based on that, he says, I don't see a woman who is fantasizing about doing that which is permitted. I mean, what problem? But a woman fantasizing about doing that which is a soul, some forbidden sex relations. Which forbids. That applies to women as well. Gemara talks about Avodah Zarah too, that it's forbidden to fantasize about worshipping idolatry. Aval isur, the isur zeh, en lachush bistalklut ubereyat barechayim niskakim. But therefore, but he says, but that's no problem of watching animals copulating. She called elu darshim mishmartem shurak shalona bonot zelzada batala. So you see already, the corner of Moshe, there is a clear distinction between men watching animals copulate and women watching. There's no problem for women according to this. But the chush shema tavona mizeh la'areh la'asod yisurim li'ba'el la'asod. They think that maybe because she watches animals copulate, therefore she's going to think about having sex relations which are forbidden. Lo matzinu sheshayach l'chush dozeh b'stah. We don't find this. So why should you assume that a person's, you know, doing something that's improper? Chedome, Kedash Shechayim, Shehayu anash nashim mutarot estakel b'Rabbi Yochanan. We're now in the third column. The Gemara mentions that Rabbi Yochanan, he had two outstanding traits about him. I use the word outstanding advisedly. He was enormous. That's just outstanding. He was known to be very, very fat. To the point that the Gemara says that how did he have relations with his wife? But the Gemara says, love conquers all. That's the Gemara answer. Right? I mention it to the point that the Gemara asks the question. It was also mentioned, okay, the Gemara therefore also mentions that Rabbi Yochanan used to see himself outside the mikveh. He used to sit and learn outside the mikvah. Okay? And the Gemara says, why did he do so? Because Rabbi Yochanan was known for being extremely beautiful. And the Gemara said that he would sit outside the mikvah. The women, as they come out from the mikvah, I know this may not appeal to you, but I'm just mentioning, it doesn't say that Rabbi Yochanan saw them, it says that they saw him, that he would sit out of the mikvah and learn, and then when they came out of the mikvah, they looked at him, and they said that as a result, they would have beautiful children as well. Okay? So the Gemara says, so here the women are coming out of the mikvah. I can tell you what they're thinking about. And they see Rabbi Yochanan. So the Gemara asks them, how do they see Rabbi Yochanan? And you see, the Gemara doesn't say it was forbidden for Rabbi Yochanan to sit there. The Gemara doesn't say because they're going to see Rabbi Yochanan and see how beautiful he is. Okay? Whatever the reason, because they would have beautiful children too when they had relations with their husband. The Gemara does not therefore say that how these women look at him, they're going to have thoughts about sleeping with Rabbi Yochanan. The Gemara doesn't assume that. The Gemara doesn't make that assumption. Okay. Ah! Now let's continue. Let's go on. The next. This is a very important punchline here. This is true. What? Yeah, but I looked at his face. Okay, but again, I'm explaining to you that the Gemara, look at what the Moshe is trying to prove from here. You don't assume that therefore, because for some reason look at somebody, a male who's very, very beautiful, therefore you assume that they're going to have forbidden thoughts. You don't go around assuming that. he was well known for his beauty. Really, very, very good. Okay, now listen, we learned some couple important principles from Rav Moshe Mishchuva, which are very important, but now we've got the really important. Yesh isur acher b'nashim midin dat yehudit. But there is a third element that we have to be very careful, which is that a woman, that a Jewish woman is obligated to act modestly. Right? Not to act immodestly. Shalolit naif bepritzot, not to act in an immodest fashion. Ki bektubot avayin bet. Aval mitzad zeh, but based on this, hu rak kishi atzma osaka, only where she is exceptional. Aval kishederach kol haneshim b'irakeh. But if all the women in her community act this way, ain shayach lachshiv lezeh lepritzot, you can't assume that this is considered pritzot. Ve'ein chiluk ma shenaseh derach haneshim sheb'ir, and it doesn't even make, look how far Rav Moshe goes. So there's no violation of that yudit, even if the origin of this common custom amongst the women started off because of pritzot. That at some point in the evolution of how the women act, their action was at one time, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, was considered pritzot. But then it spread through the whole community of women, and now it's considered normative. Dal kopanim kiven shekenu der levishita viluchan. But since that is now the way they dress and act, ein lachshiv zera masa pritzut, you can't say that that is pritzut. In manus. But the sor aleim ela midirch chassidut. You know, based on that you did, you can only forbid it to them based on the Jewish woman should be more modest, utzniut yitera. It's not a violation of dat yudit. Notice for the motion, dat yudit, recorded a motion very clearly is a relative concept. Dat yudit depends on what the Jewish women are doing now. Not what they did 100 years ago, not 50 years ago. Even if at some point there was a change, that's not a violation, that's not called pritzut. You know, that if women who are considered normative Jews, I'm not talking about women walking, if, I can give an example. I'm not saying it's a mutter or usser, I'm not passing judgment. But if it is common that women don't wear sleeves down to their elbow, but wear a half sleeve, okay? Wear a half sleeve. Based on Dr. Yehudit, even though that may very well have been in the time of the Gemara, a violation of Dat Yehudit, the Moshe seems to suggest here that that may not be a problem of Dat Yehudit.
Why does he specifically talk about, he excludes this at the beginning, that
talking
about exposed
on the synagogue? He may be talking about sleeveless.
That Moshe.
Okay, that Moshe. Let me ask you the question. Let me ask this question a little more fundamentally. Husband comes to Beddin. These are tshuvot that actually appear in the rabbinical court record. Okay, I'm not making this up.
What was the question?
Comes to the rabbinic court, and he's a chuzer b'tshuva. He married his wife. And they were not religious. And he comes to court and says, I want to divorce my wife because she's walking around immodestly. She's walking around with the sleeves exposed and stuff like that. And so the court, at that grounds, it has to deal with the question of she violated Dat Yehudit. Is this grounds for divorce? Is she acting immodestly and the like? The court, in those cases, very often deals with these issues on a variety of grounds. One is, you know, when you married her, you knew that she walked around exposed. Right? You know she walked around sleeveless. What are you coming now? Now that you're a chuzer b'tshuva, you have a defense against her. You're perfectly happy with this. You knew this is not a new development, right? That's one approach the Beit Din will very often use. Another approach the Beit Din will very often use is to say, but that's how all women. This is no longer a violation of Dat Yehudit, but way of emotions now being. It's true, you know, it may not be proper. We as halachists may not be happy with it, but you can't come and say, she's, you know, this is chatzifuta, this is chutzpah. Where's she walking around immodestly? You know, she's not the same in all dresses. And that's not per se grounds for divorce unless she's not doing what everybody else does. Okay? Now, we're going to see if Rai doesn't mean the halachists are happy with it, the situation. The question is, how do we cope with it in a halachic sense? Is this considered a violation? Now, Rav Moshe seems to suggest, and it's very, very broad sweeping, that this is not considered a violation of that you did, to the point that even he doesn't even think that it's a problem. Is it a modest? Let me explain to you now, give me a very, very simple question. Can a woman read a hot novel? Now that's not a trivial problem. For a man, it's clearly also. Even if when he reads a sexual part, okay, he is fantasizing about his wife, that's usher. It's usher because of the problem of nocturnal emission. What about a woman? Let's try to analyze it. We don't assume that because she reads about a love scene in a book that necessarily she's gonna have thoughts about sleeping with somebody forbidden. There's no problem with nocturnal emission on the verbal. If it's common in the whole community that, and it certainly is, that everybody reads novels, which has, you know, they just read through it, you know, feel uncomfortable, but they read through it. I mean, is that considered pritzut? Is that considered something that's not normative? Is this considered that shows an action of being immodest? Would you say that this woman is immodest in that community? This is probably not. Okay? It is the same question has to do with going to the movies. There are movies that, according to this, that according to Rav Moshe, the husband can't see, and the woman might be able to see. Now, I'm telling you, I'm learning Rav Moshe. Let me not end it there, because there are other poskim who disagree with Rav Moshe and say that there's one element here that Rav Moshe has left out. And that is Kedoshim Tikkun. There's one other verse. One second. There's one other verse that also attempts to guide our lives, and that is the ideal of sanctifying our lives. Okay, and we see part of this. And this is part of this getting back to the shoelace business. The attempt at halacha is to try to take even area. You know, the Torah tells us, "Thou shalt or thou shalt not." Okay, but most of life. It's not in the black and white area, most of it is the gray. And the Torah attempts to give us these general mitzvot of trying to give us a vision of where the Torah wants us to go. What's the direction which we're headed? If I want to do the Fnim Mishurat, which way do I go? How do I act? So the Torah gives us these general mitzvot that help us direct us in our actions. One of them is Kedoshim Tiyu. And these posts say that Kedoshim Tiyu says that every action I do should be geared towards somehow, best, we're not angels, but as much as possible, to gear it towards fulfillment of a mitzvah. If I want to have sexual fantasies, I do within a marriage relationship, and I have sex with my wife, right, or my husband. These are ways in which I did, and the sexual relations are sanctified by Sheva Brachot, and they're sanctified by Mitzvah Ona, by Mitzvah Puravu, and by developing a permanent relationship and raising children together. Part of the whole experience between husband and wife. Okay? And therefore, it's a directed act. Sitting back and having sexual fantasies, reading novels, and seeing borderline pornographic movies, if nothing else, is a violation of Kedoshim Tiyu. It's not the way the Torah wants us to go. That would apply to this one. So that these folks can say that Moshe, to some extent, has been a legalist, but is missing the vision. The vision is Kedoshim Tiyu. And reading these type of novels and seeing these type of movies may be technically permissible for women, but it's not taking you that down that path of Kedoshim Tiyu. It's not the way a good boy, a good Jewish boy and girl should act. And they say, therefore, it's an usur. It means this, hashkafically, it's usur to act that way. If not, you know, halal, it's usur to act that way because it's not moving my life in that direction. It's moving it more towards condoning acts and there's a sense saving my senses.
Moving towards permissiveness.
Permissiveness, becoming, losing sensitivity to the halachic goals. And therefore these poskim say that that's missing the mark. Yeah.
I want to make sure I understand Rav Moshe. Is when he speaks about that as being relative to the times, is he referring in general, like to all aspects of that Yehudit, or just to, I mean, is it that example?
Okay, we'll deal with this when we deal with pieces there. For instance, you look in Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, that Yehudit requires, when it says you got to wear, and it has your whole hair covered, what is entailed in wearing this whole hair covered? And you look at the Rambam includes what's called a Rediv. A Rediv is a face veil. Prisha, who's living in the 1700s, end of the 1700s, says, I don't know when the last time I saw a kid. But it's in the Shulchan Aruch. It's in the Rambam. Rambam comes in under that Yehudit. What happened to Rediv? He says, it's that Yehudit, and that Yehudit is relative.
My problem with what you said is that you also use that principle relative to a woman wearing half sleeves, right? I mean,
I didn't say it was, no, excuse me. I was very, and thank you for raising it. I didn't say the halacha was permitted it. I didn't say that the halacha was happy with it. I said this is not considered kitzut. This is not a violation of that Yehudit.
But it might be a violation of something not
it might
from
be a violation of something else. That's correct.
But yeah, that indeed is defined as the things beyond the halacha that are not defined in the halacha. So that example doesn't make sense.
Correct. You're right. You're right.
But you
so let's. So, you're right. The part of the problem is that part of the problem is that I'm trying to be not telling you lies. And I know more than I've taught you. When I teach it to you, know as much as I do. But I don't want to deal with it right now. And the question is it's new relative or absolute? Is Zroa absolute relative? I mean,
no,
is Shok absolute relative?
Rav Moshe didn't, but for the record, Rav Moshe
talking about Yakyudit, Rav Moshe did not give any examples. Rav Moshe says, acting in a fashion, it says, he wants to say, maybe watching animals copulate is pasnich for a good Jewish girl. Not because it's usher because that's not usher because of the tattoo, because you're not going to say, it's not usher because of the shmatim chodelah. It's usher because of that Jewish, good Jewish girls don't do these kind of things. And Rav Moshe says, if it's considered a normative action, then that's society, it's not a question of that Jewish. That's what he's talking about. He's not talking about shepherds. The discussion about Zroa we'll get to, because you're 100% right. The only source for Zroa, as far as we know, seems to be from that Yehudit. Where do we learn about Zroa? We can learn it from the Mama. We learned it from that Yehudit. We'll come back to that. We'll be. I'm sorry, just one second.
On this, what question is he answering here?
Moshe wants to know whether there are there actions which are not technically usher because of either being used to an actual mission, which applies only to males, or because of being used to sexual thoughts, which are forbidden because pasnish for Jewish
people. That's what he was asked?
No,
he's trying to, he's trying to say, but maybe there's another answer.
What was he asked?
We don't know. Because he tells in the beginning, he's only answering what he wants to answer.
I assume
he was answering what the prohibition is. He says, he probably was asked, what's the Yisur Hira? What's the actual sexual attack?
No,
that's what the tshuva says. The title of the tshuva, Bisurei Hiru Mikad Nishmata. What is it? What's the Yisur sexual fantasy?
But I mean, for what purpose? Is this, like, if you catch your wife thinking thoughts, can you divorce her without a ketubah?
No. How do you live your life? What movies can I see? What books can I read?
But he's not saying, if you've done this, so you deserve punishment.
Me too.
Let's put it this way. He might be asking, I mean, if I could think, let's say, in a very puritanical society, right, a woman is warned against reading, you know, Lady Chatterley's Lover. Right? Today's not considered so bad. But you read it. Another question. So the question is, I read something that was improper, and she was warned 3 or 4 times not to do so. Okay? The question is, it may be that's grounds for divorce because she's acting in an immodest fashion. Okay? But Moshe wants, you might be right. But I'm not interested, I'm not here as a divorce lawyer. I'm trying to understand, I'm trying to get an understanding of what is considered immodest action. Because Moshe seems to imply that if this is normative experience in that community, if it's normative, it's not considered pritzut. It's not considered pritzut. Okay? It might be a problem of kedoshim too. And I could clearly see watching animals copulate being much less of a problem than seeing a pornographic movie. Okay, as far as kedoshim to you, because this you can say it's something sexual, you know, take scientific interest or whatever it is, you know. But I can see a difference. I can feel the difference. Okay, so I'm trying to give you, Ramosha is struggling with issues that are not so simple. I'm trying to give you certain guidelines. Okay, the other postman would disagree with Moshe, claim that he's left one fundamental issue out, and that is the vision. The vision of Kedoshim 2, which he doesn't deal with in this Tshuva, which they believe is a fundamental issue, which covers a lot of territory and forbids a lot of things.
Doesn't it actually, it's a moral issue that he said that a nice Jewish girl is pasnished. Doesn't it compare parallel with the same thing when you say, if you, for a man, if you don't wear a hat, you are a goy. No, a goy doesn't wear a hat.
It depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about sexual distraction, maybe what you're generally talking about the proper way of acting, maybe you can understand. Okay, we have to get, but those are not simple, you know, so what I'm saying? So if I'm talking about a man, whether he's sexually distracted, and that's the ultimate criteria, the question is what he's used to seeing. There may be Jews and non-Jews. If you're a woman who asks, you're asking me, how should I dress? Okay, Jewish woman, because of that, you'd be, they're supposed to be taste followers, not taste setters. They're supposed to be more modest than the world around them. That's the general principle. That's right. If you live in Me'er Shavim, it's clear, if there's a normative code of action in Me'er Shavim, and you live in a different code of action, you may have to dress for Me'er Shavim, as you may halachically be required to dress for Me'er Shavim. They may have a right to call you a prutza, because you didn't violate that yudit as far as what you did. But as far as they're concerned, you're acting improperly, because for them, they're not used to it, and that may be sexually problematic. For them. For the men of your communities. There may be a dual standard here, depending on what community you're going on. That's correct. Time is late. Good night. We'll continue.
Thank you.